As I was looking at these two passages, which basically deal with the same question of unfairness and suffering, a picture came into my mind that might help us to get an answer to this question. The picture that came into my mind was of a telescope. Can you just get that, an opened up telescope in your hand? Now, it all depends, doesn't it, which end of the telescope you look through. If you look through the wrong end of the telescope, what do you see? Well, it's a very, very far away, tiny, very constricted picture. And tragically, that is how many people look at the problem of suffering. They can't get beyond the suffering. The only thing they can see is the terrible suffering of the world or their own suffering. But if you look through the right end of the telescope, what do you see? Well, you get the big picture, don't you? And both Psalm 73 and Luke chapter 16 are looking through the right end of the telescope, because you get the whole picture. And the whole picture tells us that what goes on in this earthly life is only the first part of the picture. The really important part of the picture is what happens when you die. Where do you go when you die? If you were to die today, do you know in your heart where you would go? Well, we're going to be looking at this huge question in just a few moments. Well, I'm sure God will hear that prayer we've just sung. And as we turn now to Psalm 73 and Luke chapter 16 that deal with this question, every single one of us must have asked from time to time in our lives, why is it, God, that life is so often unfair? Why is it that so many good, decent people seem to suffer so much, while so many obviously wicked, greedy, corrupt people seem to get off with so much in this life? I became a Christian in 1962 while I was a student at Edinburgh University, and I've never forgotten being introduced to one of the most influential Christian writers of that era. His name was John Stott, and he was Minister of All Souls, Langham Place in London. And the book I was given, just as I was setting off in the Christian life, it's probably, I would imagine, still in print to this day because it's a classic, was called Basic Christianity, and dealt with all the usual themes and questions about the Christian faith. Now, I'm not sure if this quote comes from that particular book, but it is a quote from John Stott himself. And he says this: "The fact of suffering undoubtedly constitutes the single greatest challenge to the Christian faith and has been in every generation. The distribution and degree of suffering seem to be entirely random and therefore unfair. Sensitive spirits ask if it can possibly be reconciled with God's justice and love." There's the question. It is a problem that probably has kept more people out of the church than any other challenge to the Christian faith. Let's see if we can grapple with it this morning. The massacre in Dunblane was in the news again 3 or 4 weeks ago. I don't know if you noticed that, but some of the people involved were able to speak out about it. Well, I have never, ever forgotten that the very day after the massacre of those children in Dunblane, I had to take a funeral in Uphall, where I was minister. And I'd conducted the service in the church, and I was walking out of the church, walking up the path to get into the hearse in order to go to the cemetery, when suddenly I felt somebody pull my arm, and I looked round, and there was this woman with a very angry face who said in a very angry voice, "What kind of God did that?" And I was totally taken aback by that woman's anger. Now, I think if any of us here, just for a few seconds even, pause and use our common sense, we would be able to say very quickly, God didn't do Dunblane. It was actually a very evil man called Thomas Hamilton who did carry out the atrocity at Dunblane. And if, like me, and as so often in these types of cases, you really feel, well, earthly justice certainly hasn't been done, because the man took his own life before he was able to be brought to the courts of justice in this country. But whether that's the last word on justice, hold on, folks, because we're not finished with it yet. But even if that woman didn't quite mean it the way she said, and I'll be gracious enough to say, I really don't think she probably did mean it, that God literally murdered those children. Nonetheless, we've got to wrestle with the question, if God didn't do it, then God, for some strange reason, certainly allowed it to happen. And that's a hugely difficult problem, isn't it? What did these little primary children do to deserve that? Innocence with the whole of their lives ahead of them, and they're removed in that unbelievably awful way. Difficult question, isn't it? Well, some years on after Dunblane, there was another massacre of children, and I'm going to focus on children because somehow it's the suffering of innocent children that is about the worst thing I think you can get in this world, isn't it? Which of us hasn't been moved our hearts by the baby P story and the Victoria Climby story and that wee lassie that was starved to death not so long ago and those babies? How can anybody in this world murder an innocent baby? But it happens. It's awful, isn't it? Well, some years after Dunblane, there was a massacre on a far greater scale numerically than the 16 of Dunblane. It was hundreds. And it was in a place called Beslan in Russia. How quickly we forget some of these things, don't we? Do you remember those terrorists that got into that school? And I don't know how many lovely little Russian children had their lives snuffed out that day. Well, I've never forgotten. It was no less a person than the current Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who said just a few days later that that atrocity had made him seriously question his faith in a loving God. That's how real and how profound this question is. It's not an easy one. We've got no little pat answers, folks, to this question. I retired, I can't believe it, 2 years have gone. The older you get, the quicker time flies, right enough. But my two daughters gave Sandra and I an absolutely wonderful present just a few weeks after we retired in April 2008. I'd always wanted to visit the country of Poland. And Sandra and I, in fact, we'd booked two holidays to Poland in previous years. And for some peculiar reason, both these holidays had been cancelled by the tour company, so we never got. Well, my two daughters knew that I wanted to do this. And they gave us a retirement present of taking us. They went with us for 5 days to the Polish city of Krakow. And Krakow is probably the jewel in the crown in Polish cities. It's stunningly beautiful with its castle and its cathedral and its magnificent square and its old Jewish quarter. Just magic. And you could walk everywhere, so it was great. So we had a wonderful time. But not very far from this beautiful city in Poland is probably the most notorious place in the world where injustice and suffering of the innocent has been carried out. And that's the concentration camp that's infamously known to all of us as Auschwitz. Now, I've always, always had in my heart the Holocaust. And I knew there's no way I'm going to Krakow, there's no way I'm going to Poland and not going to visit the Auschwitz concentration camp. And so we did. And I don't know if any of you have ever been, but words can't describe. My younger daughter could only take so much of it and said, "Dad, we'll see you in the cafe when you've done what you want to do." Now, everybody here knows probably that 6 million Jews perished in that terrible Holocaust in the 20th century. But how many of us know that of those 6 million, 1 million, one-sixth of them were innocent little children? One of the most famous, probably the most famous, Anne Frank from Holland. If you visited the Holy Land and you visited Jerusalem, just in the outskirts of Jerusalem is an unforgettable memorial called Yad Vashem. It's the museum and memorial of the Holocaust. And every time I've been to Israel, of course, I've gone there as well. But in the most recent visit, a number of years ago now, a new part of that memorial had been opened. And I don't know how I could describe it. You go in this little corridor, it's absolutely pitch dark. And you have to literally hold on to the railings to find your way through this twisting room. But gradually in the pitch dark, there's a wee candlelight appears. And it's reflected all over the glass walls of this particular place. And as you go through this, you hear names. Sometimes it's a wee boy, sometimes it's a wee girl. And these are the names of some of the million Jewish children that perished. And you come out of that place and your heart is in shreds and you're weeping buckets at the massacre of the innocent. It's hard, isn't it? It's a hugely difficult question. And this is the question this psalmist raises at the beginning of Psalm 73. "I saw that things go well for the wicked," he says. "They do not suffer pain. They are strong and they're healthy. They do not have the troubles that other people have. They wear their pride like a necklace and their violence like a robe. Their hearts pour out evil, and their minds are busy with wicked schemes. They laugh at other people, and they speak of evil things. They're proud, and they make plans to oppress others. They even speak evil of God in heaven. Even some of God's people are influenced by them and turn to follow them." And then these evil people go on to say this: "God will not know. The Most High will not find out what we're doing." That's what the wicked are like. They have plenty and are always getting more. Have things changed in the 21st century? It's exactly the same, isn't it? We've got the fat cats of this world. And if you've maybe looked at some of the documentaries that have been on TV recently, the children of Nigeria, whose life consists of going to the rubbish dump every day to pick up bits of plastic to earn a few pennies. Life is grossly unfair. And the psalmist goes on to say, it makes me even question the whole point of my own existence. "Why have I bothered," he says, "to keep myself pure and not commit sin when all that seems to happen to me is that I suffer?" And he goes on to say, I tried to think this problem through, but it was too difficult for me. And sadly, I don't know if there's anybody here, even though you're sitting in a church this morning, sadly, that's where a lot of people in this world put a full stop. They can't get beyond the injustice and the suffering, and they say, I cannot find an answer to this question. And they put a full stop there, and therefore they lose any faith they had, or they cannot find any faith at all. Now, hold on to your seatbelts. There is actually no full stop at that point in the psalm. Just listen to this. I tried to think this problem through, but it was too difficult for me. No full stop. Until I went into your temple, Lord, then I understood what will happen to the wicked. What do you think the psalmist found when he went into the house of God? Well, he found this book. And he opened up this book. And he finds that up until now, he's been looking through the wrong end of the telescope. And he's not been able to get beyond the suffering and the injustice. But when he comes into God's house, what does he find? This book is like the telescope through which you look from the right end. And you see that this is the real answer to the story. Not this, but this. And the answer to the story is that this life is appallingly unfair sometimes. But this life is not the last word. It's appointed unto all of us to die. And after that will come the judgment on us all. And here's the judgment on the wicked people of the world, the psalmist finds. You will put them in slippery places. You'll make them fall to their destruction. They'll be instantly destroyed and go down to a horrible end. They're like a dream that goes away in the morning. When you rouse yourself, Lord, they will disappear. We don't like sermons about judgment and hell, do we? Jesus Christ spoke more about judgment and more about hell than he did about heaven. And this is the reality of this psalm. Now, his famous parable is exactly in agreement with that. Life isn't fair, is it? It's not fair that you've got one man living in a palace with luxurious food and designer clothes and the latest gadgets and all the rest of it. And not a worry in the world. And at the gate of the mansion is lying a man in rags, eating crumbs. And he's sick and his body's weeping sores. And the dogs come along the road and lick the sores of the man. Life is not fair, is it? And it isn't. But Jesus does not end his story at that point, you see. The point of the story is the big picture. Both these men die. And the poor beggar dies and finds himself in that place promised in the book of Revelation. There will be no more death, no more sickness, no more pain, no more sorrow, no more sighing, for the former things will be passed away. And he's in the paradise of the new life. And the man who had everything in this world, but no faith in his heart towards God, dies and finds himself not only in a lost eternity, but totally unable to get from that place he's in to the paradise he sees the rich man in. One of the things that bothers me, I don't know if it bothers you, but it really bothers me, I think one of the curses of our modern society right now is the cult of celebrity. Have you noticed it? Everybody wants to be a celebrity. Or a lot of people want to be a celebrity. And they think, if only I can get all that money, or if only I can get all that power, or if only I can get all that fame, or if only I could get into that position, then I will have it made in this life. And folk are hooked by it. And even if they can't be celebrities themselves, they buy these stupid magazines that tell you the latest thing about Jordan or whoever it is now. And it's ridiculous, isn't it? Not to mention the world of football. Thank God for some like Marvin Andrews, who's a good one. But many of the others are trapped into this lifestyle. Remember the story Jesus told of a rich farmer who was so rich, he'd so much, he had a problem. And he solved the problem by pulling it all down and building it all bigger and better. And then when he had achieved that, he sits back in his rocking chair. And he's got a pint of beer in one hand and his pipe in the other. And he's sitting there drinking and smoking. And he's saying to himself, take your ease now, son. You've got it made. Eat, drink, and be merry. And that night. You know, somebody told me a very scary story after the Kirk Newton service this morning. That her husband had a boss once who was like that. Who had absolutely everything that this world could have. And the boss was going on holiday. And the boss said to the man that was in Kirk Newton Church this morning, the man in Kirk Newton Church this morning said to his boss, I hope the sun will shine on you. And you know what the boss said? I don't need the sun to shine on me, he said. That night, that man died. Scary stuff, isn't it? It is appointed us once to die. And Jesus said, what use is it if in the end you've gained the whole world? All the fame and the money and the power and the celebrity. What use is that if in the end of the day you lose your soul and you're lost? I told you a true story from a ministry about a scorpion this morning. And I want to end with the most moving true story, I think, of mine. I've had many, but this is, I think, unquestionably, but the most moving story in my ministry, and it happened in my first congregation. Atheists are very much in the news just now. They're gloating and they're dominating. And the persecuted people of Great Britain now, you better believe it, are Christians. Some Christians are being hauled into courts of law at this very moment in our country because of the convictions of their faith. And that's only going to get worse. And atheists are having a field day, and humanists and secularists. We've got the Richard Dawkins, we've got the Christopher Hitchens. I got the Sunday Times this morning. I was able to read a page or two before I came out. And a prominent American atheist has joined the lists of those who are demanding that the Pope is arrested the minute he sets foot in British soil in September. Now that's another issue. And the child abuse is a horrendous thing there as well. But it just shows the level of opposition that the church is facing right now. Well, I've got a quote from a famous atheist of some years ago. His name was Bertrand Russell, very prominent philosopher and atheist. And here's what he said. No one could sit besides the bed of a child with a terminal disease and believe in a loving God. No one could ever sit beside the bedside of a child with a terminal disease and possibly believe in a loving God. That's a hard test, isn't it? It may be this is touching some of you, if any of you have lost a child like that. Very hard, isn't it? A challenge to our faith. Well, the true story I want to tell you is this. In my first congregation, I had what you would call then, not so much now, a model family. A husband and a wife and a 10-year-old boy and a 7-year-old girl. The wife was a very committed member of the church, came every Sunday without fail. The husband was not a member of the church, but he came every Sunday night, interestingly enough, to the evening service. And he freely admitted to me that he had doubts, and that one of the things he found really hard to believe was that there was such a thing as life after death. Carol, the 7-year-old girl, was stunningly beautiful. She was a really bonny wee lassie, not only physically, but she had a wonderful nature, happy, pleasant, really nice wee girl. And Carol got a cancerous tumour. And it's to the nature of the wee girl that when she was in hospital and she was given some colouring paper and pens, she used to draw pictures of angels. That's the sort of girl Carol was. Well, the tumour was removed and we all rejoiced. And then I can't remember how long it was after this. I was looking out of the manse window one morning, and it was a school day when all the children were at school. But oh dear, there's little Carol skipping along the road with her mum. Skipping along the road with her mum. I thought, oh, what's going on here? Why is Carol not at school today? And I think you know the answer. Tragically, the cancer was back. This time, inoperable. What a challenge to the minister, and what a challenge to the Christians of the church. How do you cope with a thing like that? Well, we'd begun to know and believe in those days, in the early 70s, that God really was moving among us. And we believed that God answered prayer and that God could even heal today. And I asked this family if they would mind if I went round one night soon. And what I would do in the room would, I would lay my hands on Carol and I would anoint her with oil in the name of Jesus, as it describes in the New Testament. And the family were very open and very positive about that. So I arranged to go round, and I got lots of the Christians in the church, of course, to pray at the same time I was going. Well, I went round to the house, into the room, Carol lying on the bed, but intelligent, compos mentis, understanding, and explained to Carol what we were going to do. And we had that little service in the room, and a beautiful, beautiful, simple little service, and a sense of God's peace. And amazingly, from that moment, Carol never suffered any pain again, and we rejoiced in that. Now, I can't remember how much longer it was, whether it was several weeks or how long it was, but I've never forgotten 8 o'clock this morning, the phone rings, and I pick it up, and it's Carol's dad. Carol has passed away. And that raises questions, doesn't it? God, if you could heal her by taking away her pain, why not complete? But anyway, I said, right, I'm coming round right now. And I got out and went round to the house, up into the room. And I'll never, ever forget what I saw in that room that day. Carol, beautiful wee girl, lying on the bed with an absolutely angelic smile on her face. And it was the most moving thing I think I've ever experienced. And I would defy anybody, not least her dad, to say there's no life after death. And, you know, there was a sequel. That family was so moved themselves by this in the midst of their pain. Anybody that came to the house, they said, would you like to go up and see Carol? And some did. And somebody told me, when I opened that door and went into that room, I felt, I need to take my shoes off here because I'm standing on very holy ground. And that was it. And you see, that, friends, is the big picture. That's the ultimate answer to suffering and to injustice. Christ died to remove it. O death,
Where is your sting? O grave, where is your victory? But the challenge for every one of us here this morning is this. Is that sting still around for you? Because you've not yet put your whole trust in Jesus who died for you. Or can you say with Paul this morning, O death, where is your sting? O grave, where is your victory? Thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ.